The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Grit, pluck, mettle, all qualities mostly associated with the greatest generation. They are also among the non-academic skills that schools are now required to measure and will be judged on under updated federal education law. The debate over how to measure them is in full swing among educators and administrators. And all eyes are on California, where schools in several districts will begin testing grit, empathy, self-control, joy, and other hard-to-quantify social-emotional skills this year. Kate Zernike is national correspondent for The New York Times and has been covering a new set of questions over school testing. Kate, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So what exactly is grit, and can it be taught in the classroom?
Well, grit is a term that's popularized by a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Angela Duckworth, and it really refers to probably what you would think it is, which is the perseverance to stick with your goals and to achieve your goals, to stay with something for a long time. So I think we can all agree that we want kids to have this, and that frankly many good teachers are already developing in their students. In 2011, there was new evidence that looked at programs that teach grit and other what are called social-emotional learning skills. And the evidence was incredibly powerful. Kids who had been in these programs had, on average, an increase of 11 percentile points in their academic performance. So there's real evidence that teaching these kind of skills could get kids to be better on things like math and reading, the things that we've always wanted them to learn. What's happening now is people are saying, well, if we really want schools to teach these skills, we need to test them for it, because we know that in our data-driven age, if we want something to happen, we have to have data for it. We have to be able to test it. That's what's going to make people take this seriously.
But how do you test students for it?
There has been a lot of evidence, including by Angela Duckworth, who popularized the term grit, that it is very hard to test this. Typically, what we use are self-reported surveys of teachers, parents, students. And we all know that when you're filling out a form, there's sort of a tendency to think about, well, what's the answer they want me to give here, right? Like, how great was your experience? Well, you know, they were pretty nice to me, I'll give them a 5 out of 5. So it is very subjective. It's sort of, you know, it depends sometimes on the time of day that you ask kids. Other things are things like, you know, the classic marshmallow test is a great way to test for self-control. But once you've tested one student and they go back and they tell their classmates that there's this marshmallow test and you have to wait longer to get asked for the marshmallow and that's going to score you higher, it's very hard to replicate these tests. It's very hard to scale those tests up and test them on a bunch of kids.
Well, I did take that sample test that you have on the New York Times website. Came up somewhat gritty, but it was pretty easy to see what, you know, the gritty answerist would have been. Pretty easy to game. So are there any alternate options to this self-survey test?
Well, there are some interesting ones, but again, they all raise some issues. So one thing that some researchers have suggested is looking on students' online activity. So you might look at, you know, Khan Academy is something where they, you go on and you take these online courses. You might look at students' Facebook posts or their Twitter posts and see, you can judge things like conscientiousness, their reactions to events. So you can see certain behaviors, but again, do we really want to be policing students or even monitoring students' Facebook and Twitter posts?
I mean, those are really psychology tests, but they're being used in this kind of educational setting. How do they stack up against all of the other measures of a school performance?
Well, I think, we don't have as much sort of historical evidence or experience writing these kind of tests as we do with tests of reading, math, writing, et cetera. But also keep in mind that, for instance, the California districts, which you mentioned, so they're sort of, as you said, the pioneers in measuring this. And when they measure it, they're going to count academic scores for 40% of a school's overall score. Social-emotional learning is going to count for 8%. 8% is a fairly small measure. This is not what you would call a high-stakes test where someone's going to lose a job or not get a diploma if they don't do well.
How do you measure grit, empathy, self-control, joy? That's a question that's being taken up now among educators and administrators across the country and will soon be tested in several California school districts. Kate Zernike is with us. She's national correspondent for The New York Times and has been covering the debate over how to measure these non-academic attributes that school performance is now being judged on. Dr. Angela Duckworth, who you mentioned as popularizing the whole concept of grit, she is against measuring and testing. Why?
Again, what she's saying is that we just don't have the measures yet, and it's too subjective, and we just, you know, we can't do this, and there's all sorts of, you know, what she says is that it's sort of incentivizes kids to sort of to parrot the right things without really thinking them through. There's another woman whose work is very well known in this area, Carol Dweck, who's a professor in California. She's developed this idea of a growth mindset. You don't praise a student for, you don't say you're so smart, you say you tried really hard, I'm really proud of you. And Carol Dweck has said she's concerned about this because we've started sort of praising kids for trying hard as if trying hard is all that matters. And what she will say is, what she's written is that, you know, it's not enough just to try hard. You have to encourage them to try hard and to do well and to teach them the satisfaction of growing and developing. Hmm. But I think there's a lot of concern in teaching these skills that it becomes very empty. The reason that advocates for particularly poor black and brown children pushed for higher academic standards in schools was because there had become this sort of focus on self-esteem. And it was, well, the kids feel good, and so everyone's happy, so why are you going to, you know, they're learning, and we're going to pass them on from grade to grade, even if they're not learning anything. So I think the concern is that we're going to focus too much on this. Everyone really thinks what the California districts are doing is that they're doing it very carefully, they're doing it very thoughtfully, but the concern is what happens when this, you know, when this starts getting into every school district, and they haven't thought it through quite as well.
Hmm. These so-called social-emotional skills that are being tested, grit, empathy, self-control, joy, are these part of the Common Core?
No, they're not. The Common Core is a set of academic standards that was developed by the National Governors Association and some National Education Associations. The Common Core is a set of standards of things that we would like our kids to know, but they really are more academic focused. You know, being able to analyze foundational texts like the Declaration of Independence, being able to talk about an author's point of view. So those are really more academic standards. When you talk about testing for this kind of thing, it's actually tied separately, as the Common Core is not, to federal law. There's a federal law that governs education, and it's updated periodically. And in the most recent update, which President Obama signed in December, says that schools have to include at least one non-academic measure in their testing. So that's why people are looking to this idea of social-emotional skills. Is this the non-academic measure that we can test? One interesting thing to me is I think, you know, a lot of the reason that people want to teach social-emotional skills is because they think it focuses more on what you would call the whole child, and that in our focus on, in our excessive emphasis on test scores and on academic tests, standardized testing, we've gotten away from that focus on the whole child. So there is sort of this, you know, it's almost a contradiction in terms. We want to focus more on the whole child, but as a way of focusing on the whole child, we're going to test for social-emotional skills, which just brings us more tests. So there's a certain circularity to it that I think people object to as well.
What are some of those other non-academic measures that President Obama mentioned?
President Obama and Congress left it very much to the states to decide what those measures are going to be. So what states are looking at are things like absentee rate, you know, chronic absenteeism, school climate. So, you know, you might survey parents and talk about how safe they feel. You might actually talk about discipline in schools. So how many students were given out-of-school suspensions, and the idea is not to suspend so many students. So there are many other ways to look at non-academic measures.
So, Kate, California and these districts first to roll out these tests. How much time is it going to take to get a read on them, and what's the timeline for the rest of the country?
Well, California has started doing these. The core districts have started doing these report cards that include things like school climate. Social emotional learning skills will be, and the results of these tests will be, results of these surveys, which are the tests, will be included in the 2016 measures. So the 2015 measures came out, I believe, in early February. So I would expect by, you know, this time next year, we'll have a better read on how they've done on the social emotional skills. California, like every other state, is in the process of developing its accountability system. And that means what measures it's going to report to the federal government. So we know they have to report academic measures. What is the non-academic measure they want to use? And California, of course, as we know, is such a sort of influential player in all debates, all policy debates for the country, because it's simply so big. So I think other states are also looking at this. And I would say by this time next year, we'll have a better sense of what it would look like.
Kate Zernike, she's national correspondent for The New York Times. You can read more about grit in schools, and you can take that New York Times grit test. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. No cyberbullying, no questionable photos, no posting after hours. Parents often set strict rules for their kids when it comes to social media, but it is not a two-way street. A new study out of the University of Michigan reveals that children want more rigid guidelines for what their parents post on social media, namely potentially embarrassing photos and stories. KJ Dell'Antonia wrote about the issue for the New York Times Well blog. And KJ, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. It's always fun to be here.
So children want guidelines. What are they asking for?
Children want their parents to ask them before they post things. And in a lot of cases, not to post things at all. It was really interesting to the researchers. What they found was that about three times as many kids asked for this particular rule as opposed to parents. Very few parents suggested it as a rule at all.
Well, when we talk about children, we're saying what age range? Are these teenagers, tweens, what?
These were 10 to 17-year-olds.
So it can get kind of murky. I mean, a post about potty training may be embarrassing 10 years from now. But what is the line? Are newborn photos okay, or posts about the terrible twos off limit?
Well, when it comes to things like potty training and picky eating and stuff like that, the posts that parents share on social media can really help to create a community around parenting. So, you know, in the end, those are helping the kids as well as the parents, because a child whose parents are feeling, you know, a little more supported, a little more happy, a little more comfortable is probably getting a better deal out of those parents. But on the other hand, it is worth thinking about, you know, if you're going to end up with a 10-year-old who is looking at even an innocuous picture of her cooking or her team winning a game and say, I don't want you to share that. Maybe your 10-year-old would have rather you didn't get quite so specific about the picky eating or, worse yet, the potty training.
Well, it's going to cut down things for a lot of parents, I would imagine.
It really is. It does for me. I was already pretty private, at least about pictures of my kids. But now that it's really occurred to me to actually ask, I don't even share as much fun things because at least one of them is just not, you know, she just doesn't necessarily want to be out there in that way.
Is that age-based, these kind of rules?
They were age-based. The researchers found that the older the kid, the more likely they were to say or have said, you know, please don't put things up without asking me, or to bring this up as a possible issue. I think some of that is, you know, it not occurring to kids at a younger age. And of course, some of it is just getting to be a teen.
But this is within your family. I mean, it's tough when you have other parents, you know, other kids' parents, other family members, aunts, uncles, grandparents. How should all that be handled?
I don't know. I think if you've got a grandparent sharing the occasional picture on social media, unless it's really out of hand, you can probably talk to your teenager and say, you know, it's grandma. Odds are your friends are not following her. It's okay. You know, take a step back. I think when it comes to family members that it's probably not such a big deal. But on the other hand, you know, I interviewed one parent who said that her 7-year-old had mentioned that she'd come home from a field trip and hidden every time the parents on the field trip got out their cameras because she, quote, you know, didn't want to be on the Facebook. So some little kids will look at the camera and run at this point.
I guess we should take that as a good sign after a lot of warning kids to protect their own privacy. But we're looking at Facebook, launched 2004, Instagram 2010. So this is a relatively new phenomenon. How do you see this conversation evolving in the coming years for the next generation?
It really is new. We're definitely the first generation to grow into something like this at the same time as our kids do. I think we will probably find ourselves relying on it less, sharing less, getting used to it. I mean, the novelty of Facebook has been a huge thing. The novelty of sharing all the pictures with people. I think that's part of what will evolve the conversation. And the other piece of it is that, you know, you're going to be hard-pressed to find a child without some kind of embarrassing documentary evidence of their toddler days online. I can't imagine anybody's going to go through big searches to find it.
Well, KJ, thank you again for joining us on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
KJ Dell'Antonia. She's contributing editor and columnist for the New York Times Well Family blog. You can find a link to read her article, Don't Post About Me on Social Media, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from parents out there. Do you have ground rules for what you post about your children on social media? Let us know. Where else but on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. There is no regulation length for academic classes. They can range from 40 to 90 minutes depending on the school and which grade is being taught. And teachers can't count on all of that time being productive, since class doesn't always start when the bell rings. This next piece comes to us from the podcast SIFT.
Okay, so we're going to get started.
So,
good morning.
Okay, so.
This is SIFT. I'm your host, Bishop Sand. Teachers must start classes very quickly and very deliberately. They do this for many reasons, setting a tone, setting a routine, making the classroom a safe space. And the root of all these reasons is to improve students' learning. But this time is not easy for teachers. It's incredibly stressful. There are so many things to think about. So I ask teachers what they're thinking when they start class.
Class starts about 2 minutes before class starts.
Bonjour, la classe.
In that last minute, it's running around making sure things are on the board for students to be able to do. You have a vague recollection of where the handouts are that you're probably going to lose in a few seconds anyway. The technology, which is probably going to break, is set up. I try to be outside in the hall.
Hi.
So that way I can be border control.
Actually, you shake our hand before walking to the door.
And try to get to everybody.
We're good.
I'm shaking their hands and saying, how are you? Giving them a smile, and they come in,
finding out how their day is. And the goal is get the students inside to be representative and modeling what the students outside should be looking like once they get inside. Then it's reminding about the homework, asking them about the do now.
The do now is the initial activity.
And simultaneously trying to look back inside the room to make sure that students are sitting in a way that's going to get them started, so that way I can turn back to the door and get those people to look at the people on the inside and say, kind of do that. But if anybody's not doing, quote, that, I need to fix what they're doing. So while that's happening, it's checking uniform. Take attendance, collect homework.
Homework today, right?
So far, no. Two people have completed the due now. Let's get going, okay? You
should have your worksheet. Check in about the due now. Relocate the papers that I swore I just put down on this desk and now aren't here anymore. Talk to the students about why they were absent yesterday. Figure out how this one's doing at home. Talk about the paper that this one's either doing or not doing. Once we're all inside,
okay, ladies and gentlemen,
calming the conversation that's now happening about something completely unrelated between student A and B in the back of the classroom, and oh yeah, don't forget to take the attendance and get it into the folder in the first few minutes.
You guys 2 minutes, I'll just do the attendance while you guys should be wrapping up.
You give him about 2.5 minutes to finish what they're doing, and you don't want them to get terribly comfortable.
He grabs everybody's attention pretty easily.
So then I just kind of spread my hands out as wide as I can, and I just make this huge clapping sound.
Oh, he screams really loud.
Yeah, he does.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming. That means our time is up.
And they're shocked by it every single day, even though they know I'm going to do it. And all of those things need to happen in the first 5 minutes, and then you know, that's usually the point where I lose the papers again, and then we need to kind of refocus.
I'm sorry. We're going to go through the due now, get some answers up on the board, and review what we did oh so many days ago.
That's it for this episode of SIFT. Special thanks to the teachers you heard in this episode. They were Melanie Mack, Gavin Nangle, Daniel Bronfeld, and David Sharon.
And that story was produced by Bishop Sand, host of the podcast SIFT. When we come back, we're going to dismiss class for something that may be just as valuable, Recess, the power of play, when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you think of grammar school, do you remember reading circle, doing long division, or is it easier to conjure images of the open-air clamor of recess? Maybe you can remember the bell ringing, unleashing peals of laughter, or those formative tests of daring and performance on the schoolyard, those arguments over the rules. Dan DeSorbo and Ben Applebaum think we should do less work and have more recess. They both work for fancy advertising firms and have together written several books encouraging people to do things that aren't considered productive, like playing beer pong or bar hopping. Their newest is Recess, from dodgeball to double dutch, classic games for players of today. It's a guide to help kids and adults reclaim the playground state of mind and share it with others. And Dan DeSorbo is here with more. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You and Ben are both dads now, is that correct?
Correct.
So does that mean your days of writing about bar hopping and being a party animal books are over?
Maybe not. But for the time being, I'd say yes. Yeah, Ben actually has two girls, and I have two boys, which is funny.
So is this book more for parents or for kids?
We like to say it's for both. It's for everybody. We think recess, you know, primarily seen as a child activity, but I think adults can get a lot out of playing some of these games.
And some of them do feel nostalgic. I mean, there are rules for jacks and marbles. I mean, I think I've seen that on The Little Rascals or something like that. Is there a goal of sort of reviving these games?
Yeah, so a little bit of both. So, I mean, recess has been around, you know, since actually some of these games go back to, you know, 2800 BC. But the games themselves have been around since before the internet, so there's no sort of cohesive book of these games. So what we wanted to do is sort of make sure that they don't get lost to the screens of today and are still played throughout neighborhoods throughout the world even.
Anything in particular you discovered while researching that you decided to play and really took a shine to?
Yeah, so, you know, with two boys at home, they're 6 and 3, so I wasn't able to play all these games with them, but I did try as many as I could, and one of the games that I was surprised was a big hit is marbles. I never played it as a kid, but when I started playing to figure out the best way to write these rules of these different games of marbles, my kids were in love with the game, so we still play, actually, daily, games of marbles.
Well, there are about 20 variations of optional four-square rules, including death rallies, frenzies, lumberjacks. How do you research this kind of book? Do you stand out and watch kids?
Yeah, so a little bit of everything. A lot of it was just, honestly, Ben and I just remembering the games that we played and putting our thoughts down. I mean, the beauty of these games, like I said before, is, you know, brothers pass them on to their sisters or their cousins or one generation passes it down to another. So there's that aspect of these games where we kind of encourage these regional, really almost made-up versions of some of these games. So for Foursquare, for example, you know, there is the traditional way to play, but like you just mentioned, depending on where you are, there might be 20 to 30 other rules out there that, you know, we want to make you aware of. And, you know, even try them out for yourself might make it more fun.
Well, there is a warning in the beginning of the book that starts, the games described in this book can be dangerous, and we're talking about more than scraped knees and bruised egos. And I look through them and I think, oh, pencil fights? You know, you're going to poke an eye out. So are you among those who think that kids today may be too coddled and could actually benefit by playing games that could get rough?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think some of the rough games are maybe in people's heads, they think they're more violent than they need to be. You know, we wanted to present those games in a way that there is a chance that, you know, there might be a knee scrape or, you know, a ball to the head. But, you know, I mean, growing up, even hearing stories from my parents, we all went through these growing pains, I guess. So I don't think we need to be protecting our kids from a soft rubber ball. I think maybe we should be protecting them from some other things that could be a lot more dangerous.
There's one section in particular that we zoned in on. This was how to punch a friend.
So right.
We don't see this in all of your game books, but there are some pretty good tips in there about how to punch someone in a joking way. So explain the nuances there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that goes back to, you know, you do punch your friends. It's fun. It's something you do. We just try to outline a way where it's, you know, you're not going to hurt them, maybe to the point where they're going to go run home and need to see a doctor. So, you know, we teach you where to aim, so it's a little bit more of a loud smack rather than a harmful crunch, kind of a chummy pop. You know, don't go to hurt. I mean, yeah, there's a fine line between having fun, being competitive, and bullying,
man,
really. So we like to avoid the bullying part.
You also include celebration techniques, you know, how to jump up in the air when someone makes a home run and other victorious moments. Do you think that people are that out of touch that they can't even remember how to celebrate?
I do. I mean, part of the kind of setup for the book is, you know, don't be a poor sport. You know, so a lot of times now we're bragging when we win instead of celebrating, you know, the fun we just had or the great play somebody just made. Instead, it's more like, you know, trying to rub it in. So yeah, a lot of these celebrations are more, how are we happy that we just had a great time, rather than how do I make my opponent feel like, you know, they're a big loser.
So okay, you're advocating that adults play these games, get in touch with their inner recessor.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think, like in the middle of the day at work, should we be, you know, finish lunch, the bell rings, we go out and play recess for a little while?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even need to be for, you know, a full 30 minutes. Like, even at my office, we have a small little basketball hoop. We have a couple other silly game setups that, you know, maybe we want to go over a meeting point where instead of just kind of sitting at a table going back and forth, where, you know, we're playing a game of horse while we're still talking about the meeting. It actually, I think, makes your thought process a little more creative.
Well, Dan, thank you for playing.
Thanks for having me.
Dan DeSorbo, he's managing partner at PBNJ Design. Also co-author with Ben Applebaum of Recess, From Dodgeball to Double Dutch, Classic Games for the Players of Today. They've co-authored several other books together, including The Book of Beer Awesomeness and The Book of the Party Animal. You'll find a link to more on their new book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Hey, yeah. Yeah. How you feeling?
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Felice Brothers are a relatively young band, but with a distinctive old-school feel. They made their way from backyard shows, busking on the streets and subways of New York, to a rollicking, rootsy sound that brings to mind Dylan and the Dead.
Down on the street, I got someone I really want you to meet.
And they're coming to 3S Art Space in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, this Friday, March 25th. James, the younger of the two actual brothers who are still in the band, plays accordion and sings. And he spoke with producer Taylor Quimby about some influences, traditions, and whiskey.
I am James Felice, in the band The Felice Brothers.
How old were you when you and your brother first started making music together?
My brother and I started when I was, I guess, 19 or 20. We started off trying to play our own tunes. Ian just turned out to be an excellent songwriter for some reason. He was my older brother. He is my older brother. So he was cool. And what he liked, I also liked. So he informed my musical taste big time.
Listening through to some of your older albums, You know, there's one of my favorite tracks is Whiskey in My Whiskey. And, you know, you talked about doing some of the sort of traditional songs, you know, taken from folk and roots music. And why is it that whiskey plays such a big role, do you think, in that type of music, as opposed to other types of alcohol?
Whiskey is, you know, I'm not sure, but it felt right. I think whiskey is always associated with, like, hard times. I mean, it feels like an American drink. I mean, bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, and of course there's like Jack Daniels, and there's just this like sort of this iconic Americana thing that we all seem to just recognize immediately. And then when you put in like a country song, it just completely makes sense. It's sort of cheating how easy it is to just throw the word whiskey in a song and make it feel authentic or like you know what you're talking about.
So why not double down and throw it twice in the chorus?
Yeah, why not just say it twice in the chorus, and that's you really maximize your impact.
I put some whiskey into my whiskey. I put some heartbreak into my heart. I put my boots on that old dance floor. I put three rounds, Lord, in my 44. I loved a girl, she was my son.
Let's talk a little bit about your most recent album, Favorite Waitress. You said you're interested in songs with good characters, and it made me wonder, is there a favorite waitress for whom this album was named, or was it just sort of a good title for an album?
I think it was a good title for an album. I mean, it was like what's that word? It's a combination of a bunch of different people in our lives. When you're a touring musician, you spend a lot of your time at like diners and restaurants, and there was something really nice about a waitress sort of being nice to you and serving you food and it made us feel welcome and taken care of when we were on the road.
Well, and there's something about a home away from home at a diner, right?
There really is. There's something amazing about being able to go into a diner almost anywhere in this country and be reminded of being young or being a child. I remember my mother taking me to the diner when I was a kid and getting like, you know, the $2 breakfast special, eggs over easy, home fries and toast. And you can still get that in a lot of places and it almost always works.
All I want to eat is cherry licorice. I don't care if it sounds ridiculous. Even the birds and bees eat how they damn well please. I don't want to work for no dead waitress.
I'm always curious, sort of, what's the difference for you between, you know, stealing a tune, borrowing a tune, making an homage, you know, redoing a classic? What, you know, where do those things fall?
I think, yeah, you're always stealing as a musician. I think any artist will say that half of what you do is just repurposed from other musicians. And then there's a really strong tradition of that in the folk and country world, particularly. I think the important thing is just make it your own. If you can add something to the song, or if you want to take a melody or an idea in a direction that maybe it wasn't originally taken in, I think that's really a valuable and beautiful thing to do.
Yeah.
Listening to music of the past is all we have. It's what it is, our education as musicians, is to listen to what they did before us.
My car goes Chicago every weekend. I pick up some cargo. I think I know the bloody way by now, Frankie. I turn the goddamn radio down, thank you. Pull over, count the money, but don't count the 30 in the glove box, buddy. That's for to buy Lucille some clothes. Bang, bang, bang went Frankie's gun.
He shot me down to see you.
Bang, bang, bang went Frankie's gun.
This is off topic, but I heard that Welcome to Night Vale used one of your tracks. Are you guys podcast fans?
Big time podcast fans. Yeah, we love Welcome to Night Vale. Joseph Fink is awesome.
Got to find something to listen to on the road, right?
Definitely. Yeah, and thank God this podcast really changed our lives, because before that it was really hard to find stuff to listen to, and now it's almost like there's too much, and it can make an 8-hour drive really fly by. It's awesome.
Well, James, we're looking forward to having you back in New Hampshire, and thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
That was James Felice of the Felice Brothers speaking with our senior producer, Taylor Quimby. The Felice Brothers are playing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth on Friday, March 25th. And you can learn more about the band and the event at wordofmouthradio.org. The Felice Brothers have put out a couple of records and a few mixtapes, but their latest album, New Waitress, was their first to be recorded in a professional studio. In this next piece, producer Allison McKay profiles an industry expert who specializes in mixing and mastering, an invisible process that most of us never think about when we hit play on our favorite tunes.
In the early years of audio recording, musicians performed live in the studio and their songs were captured directly onto a master disc.
Go back where you stayed last night. Get away from my door.
Today, the process is a little different.
I guess we'll never know.
Hey, you know, this mix sounds really good, but I think we should tweak the bottom a little bit and get a richer bass sound. What do you think?
Mastering engineer Emily Lazar is working with the Belgian pop band School Is Cool on the final mixing and mastering of its forthcoming album. She's tweaking the vocal for the song Envelop Me.
So when we EQ the vocal, we pick certain frequencies that we want to hear either more or less of. For example, in this song right now, in the raw mix, the lower frequencies of the low mids of the drums are kind of clouding up some of the other areas that we'd like to hear a little bit more of. Specifically right now, the lead vocal, we would like to have it a little bit more presence and intimacy, so that when you're listening on your headphones or in your own space, you feel like Johannes, the lead singer, is right there singing to you.
Singer Johannes Genard says those kinds of sonic adjustments are more than just sonic adjustments.
The mastering can bring to the foreground certain frequencies that we associate with certain emotions. Like certain frequencies convey more aggression or energy, and certain frequencies evoke depth. It's more like a psychological thing than a technical thing, I think.
Genard and Toon van Bylen flew in from Belgium to work with Lazar because Genard says they admired her work on Vampire Weekend's album Modern Vampires of the City, which is up this year for a Grammy.
I really like the sonic experience of listening to it. So when the time came to look at people we wanted to work with, I just put down the list of everybody who worked on that record. And we saw that Emily worked on mastering and mixing as well. And we love the fact that we can just be here while she's actually doing it and thinking of all the tweaks.
Mastering engineers often work alone, polishing several albums at once without artist involvement. But at Lazar's Greenwich Village studio, The Lodge, that's not the case.
For me, the best approach has to be a dialogue. It's the essential part of what I do.
Lazar points to a collaboration with Lou Reed on the mastering of a Best Of collection.
We really had a really wonderful time listening back to a lot of the music. And Lou hadn't initially planned to include the track New York City Man on this anthology. And when we were going through all the original analog masters, I heard the track come off the tape machine, and it was just amazing. And I looked at Lou and I said, Lou, how come this isn't on this? You are the New York City Man. And we both laughed, and it actually ended up making its way not only onto the compilation, but it became the title track.
New York City Man, you blink your eyes.
says and I'll be gone.
The work was even more collaborative with Vampire Weekend. The band sent the first single from its 2008 self-titled debut album to several mastering engineers as a way of determining the best match. As guitarist and keyboard player Rostam Batmanglish explains.
I think Emily was the only one who sent back multiple versions of the song. She sent back 6 different versions. And there was one that I thought sounded better than all the rest. And so from there, we made a decision to master the whole record with her.
I see a mansard roof through the trees. A salty message written in the eaves, the ground beneath my feet, the odd garbage and concrete. Now the tops of buildings, I can see them too.
Vampire Weekend's next 2 albums were also mastered by Lazar.
Often records are mastered within a day, but for us that hasn't been the case. In the past 2 Vampire Weekend records, Contra and Modern Vampires of the City, have actually been mastered over a multi-month period.
Sometimes they mastered directly from his laptop.
Got a little soul, the world is a cold, cold place to be. Want a little warmth, but who's gonna save a little warmth for me?
Moving elements in the stereo image makes such a huge difference. Just like if you take the analogy of making a film, if someone is in a shot and they're further away from you, or they're more to the right or to the left in a movie, all those things are going to affect how you perceive their performance. And I think that with the way that we've worked recently with Emily at the Lodge, we have that control if we want it.
In the end, it's Emily Lazar's job to be a kind of bridge between musicians and listeners.
I have these 3 huge windows in my mastering studio that look out over Astor Place. And sometimes when I'm working, I look out the window. I see people walking around downtown with their headphones on. And I like to imagine that maybe they'll be listening to the stuff that I'm working on. I get so excited and tickled. It's kind of awesome to have been a part of something that's being broadcast out to the world in that way.
So the next time you listen to a song, think about the woman who might be behind the curtain.
And that story was produced by Allison McCabe. Thanks for taking some time to listen today. There is a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can also find the Word of Mouth podcast, or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend, pass it around, post it on social media. It'll help others find it when shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.